morning. It is 9 o'clock, so we are going to get started. A couple just housekeeping things here. We are continuing with the notes from lesson 51 that I passed out on Christmas Eve when we met on that Saturday. We obviously didn't have class last week, and if you have those notes, you need to find page 7 because we left off at the bottom of page 7. Now, while you're finding that, included in that original set of notes was an appendix labeled Appendix A. Okay? That's no longer Appendix A. Appendix A is this sheet that is now in front of you. This is a expanded, better copy of that. And I'll explain what this is about when we get there. Okay? So just be aware that this this new appendix here is going to kind of, when we get there, replace the one that I have in your notes, because I found better information in between now and last time we met, so I kind of I updated it. Now, what I've done is I've taken, I understand this is technically lesson 52, as Norm pointed out, so this will be a year's worth of Sundays now, 52 Sundays after today, 52 hours of teaching on church history. I didn't really think that was going to happen when we started, but that's where we're at now.
I'm looking at a 6-point.
What's that?
6-point.
Yeah, that's for sure. So what I'm doing is I'm chunking out the lessons for the internet based on this. So what I did for lesson 51 is I just Ronnie proofread this for me, and then I just took everything out up to the bottom of page 7 and said that was lesson 51, and now we're going to be on lesson 52. And I'm going to do the same thing with the PowerPoint. Now, I do want to review just a couple things. We started by looking at Darby on Trial, debunking attacks on the pre-tribulation rapture. And what we did, and I just want to use this real quick, okay? We saw that there are essentially two different classes of arguments to try to disprove or discredit the idea that John Darby came up with this on his own through his own process of study in 1827, like we've been studying over the last few weeks now, okay? And we said that those generally fall into two categories. The first are those who say he was influenced by Jesuits, specifically Rivera and Lacunza. Now, we haven't gotten to Lacunza yet. We're going to talk about him today. And then also, the second category are those who say that it came from a demon-inspired, tongue-speaking woman in Edward Irving's church in 1832, or a visionary occult tongue-speaking Scottish girl in 1830. So what we did is we were looking at first at this first point here, that the idea that the pre-tribulation rapture was, and futurism in general, the futuristic approach to the book of Revelation, all of it lies in the future and awaits a future fulfillment. We were looking at the idea that that view originated with the Jesuits. And that line of argument again says that the Jesuits invented this, therefore it's Catholic in origin, and the pre-tribulation rapture or futurism in general is therefore false because of that. So this is what we kind of looked at, okay? Here's a quote for you, for those of you that want to see his face this morning. So, the 16th century Protestant reformers viewed the Pope / papacy as the Antichrist. Okay? Modern, should say writers, state the futurist interpretation of Revelation was invented by Jesuit monks to relieve the papacy of this Protestant stigma. Okay? So one view says that they moved it forward. So Jesuit monks Rivera and or Lacunza are said to have invented the futurist position to escape the Protestant teaching that the Pope was the Antichrist. This argument was used as a means of discrediting dispensationalism and John Nelson Darby. Now that's a review point from a few weeks ago. The other argument moved it back, and that was also invented by a Jesuit monk, at least according to what is commonly said. And he invented the preterist position, which says that everything in the Bible was fulfilled by 70 AD in order to escape the Protestant teaching that the Pope was the Antichrist. Now, we looked 2 weeks ago at Rivera, and we saw that Rivera is far from a futurist, that he is teaching a mixture of historicism, some elements of futurism, and Augustinian amillennialism. Okay? We looked at that. Then we looked at, my dad corrected me, he watched the study, and it is conflagration, not conflagration, which I was said like 30 times, apparently, in that last study. But then we looked at the two-stage pre-conflagration rapture, okay? And we saw that this was taught by Joseph Mead in 1677. A variation was taught by Increase Mather in 1709. And a variation was taught by Cotton Mather in 1729. So all three of these teachings predate Darby, some by almost 200 years. Okay? And we saw that what these views are saying, I hope you can kind of get this here, Norm, that the saints are on earth and they're persecuted by the Antichrist during the tribulation. Okay? Then stage one of the Lord's coming is the rapture of the saints to meet the Lord in the clouds, alright? That they may be preserved from the conflagration of the earth. So the saints are caught up at the end of the tribulation here to meet the Lord in the air. While the saints are with the Lord in the air, 2 Peter 3:10 is fulfilled, where the earth is destroyed by fire. It is then replaced by a new earth. And then the second stage of the Lord's coming is the Lord returns with His saints to a new earth to establish His kingdom. Okay? So you have two stages here. You have stage number one, at the end of the tribulation, the saints are caught up to meet the Lord in the air here. They are there in the earth. And if you remember from the studies, the comparison is made between the time of Noah and how God destroyed the earth through a flood with Noah and how Noah and his family were in the ark on top of the water, okay? Then the next time the Lord is going to destroy the earth, according to this view, it's going to be by fire, according to 2 Peter 3:10. The saints are going to be caught up to meet the Lord in the air, at which time the Lord in judgment is going to destroy the earth through fire here at the conflagration. So the earth is destroyed by fire. It is then replaced with a new earth. Then the saints return to this new earth with the Lord to usher in the millennial reign of Christ. Okay? Now the point here is this. Is that a two-stage coming? Stage one is here. Stage two is here. Is this a pre-tribulation rapture or a post-tribulation rapture? This is a post-tribulation rapture, okay? And again, it's being taught in 1677, a variation in 1709, and another variation in 1729. So when the author of these books right here, Dave McPherson, says, well, I'll just see if I can find it, I underlined it, in multiple... I got like all the books I could find here on this. He says, he basically says that nobody before the year 1830 taught a two-stage coming. Is he wrong? He is 100% what? Wrong. Because Joseph Mead does it in 1677, Increase Mather does it in 1709, and Cotton Mather does it in 1729, all of which predate Darby. Now, do they have the rapture in what we would view as the correct place?
No.
I would say no. But do they clearly see a catching away here of the saints to meet the Lord in the air? Now again, stage one happens at the end of the tribulation. The saints are on earth and persecuted by the Antichrist. They're taken up to be preserved from the destruction of the earth by fire. The new earth is presented, and then the saints return according to this view. Alright? Again, that should pretty much be a review point from last time. Then we looked at the works of a guy named Morgan Edwards, which I know you can't read that, but Morgan Edwards writes his book in 1788. So again, we have at least 60 years, give or take, before 1830 here, where somebody is teaching this. And again, this is another review point. He says, and the living change at Christ appearing in the air, and then he quotes in parentheses, 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 17, and this will be about 3.5 years before the millennium. Okay? He then says that the catching up then is the first stage, and the saints are taken to heaven before the 1260 days, i.e., this is a mid-trib what? rapture, okay? So the saints are taken up 3.5 years before the millennium, okay? Then you have this period of 1260 days or 42 months that he talks about, where the struggling of the Antichrist towards the mastery of the world and his assumption of the Godhead will precede the millennium and be destroyed at Christ coming to reign. So you have a two-stage coming. Stage one here, before the 1260 days or 42 months, he flat out says that it's 3.5 years before the millennium. And stage two, Christ returned to earth in judgment to make war on the Antichrist. That would be here to establish the what?
Millennium.
But again, folks, do we have here a two-stage coming?
Yeah.
All right. Now again, Dave McPherson says in every single one of these books that nobody before 1830 taught a two-stage coming. That's what he says. Now,
are these current common books that are available today by McPherson?
This one was his first one, The Unbelievable Preacher of Origin. This one was written in 1973. Then he wrote in 1975, The Incredible Cover-Up, Exposing the Origins of Rapture Theories. Then he wrote another one in 1983, The Great Rapture Hoax. And then the latest one that he wrote was in, this one is in 1994, and it has gone into a second edition, The Rapture Plot.
Okay, so what is his orientation?
He's a post, he and his father are both post-tribulation historicists, essentially, from what I can gather.
You don't know what fellowship is.
No, I'm not sure. I know he was like kicked out of Wheaton College or something for some reason. I don't remember exactly why. So, but he has a vested interest in trying to say that Darby lied and that the pre-tribulation rapture did not originate with him. And that nobody before 1830 was teaching a two-stage coming. Now, folks, I can just tell you right now that is absolutely untrue. Okay? We've demonstrated at least four individuals, we demonstrated three on the previous slide, that were all teaching a two-stage coming. The first stage being the rapture of the saints at the end of the tribulation, followed by the return to a new earth after it is the first earth is the current earth is destroyed by fire. And then this one, we see Morgan Edwards teaching a mid-trib rapture of the church before the second half of Daniel's 70th week starts here, or a pre-1260-day, i.e. a mid-trib rapture view. Both of these have the Lord coming in how many stages?
Two.
Okay? So, if you would look now at page 7. If you would look at page 7.
Pastor, those what you've got on the wall there, is this stuff that you've already had, is it something I've missed when I've been gone there?
This is basically what I drew on the board a few weeks ago. Okay. I wanted to make something that I could put on the internet where somebody could kind of see what the view is actually saying, and this is like the best I could come up with, right. At least right now. So if you will look at page 7, commenting on Morgan Edwards, okay? I want you to go halfway down page 7 where it says, In the Rapture Plot. That's this book right here, okay? In the Rapture Plot, McPherson makes the following statement about a pre-1260-day rapture of Morgan Edwards. Edwards' scheme of a rapture 3.5 years before the end of the 1260 year, so he changes it to a year, tribulation. At the same tiny gap a futurist would have if he were to teach a rapture 3.5 days before the end of the 1260-day tribulation. Since such a futurist view would be seen as a post-trib view, Edwards should be classified as historicist post-trib. Okay? However, look at the next point. Heidner correctly points out the following implicit admission on the part of McPherson. Even so, that would be an historicist post-trib holding to a two-stage coming. So after all, even with his humbug explaining away the plain fact that Morgan Edwards viewed the 1260 days as days, not years, he ends with the implicit admission of a two-stage coming, trying to minimize the thrust of this by referring to a tiny gap of 3.5 days. It sounds like a biased claim game is at work, not sobriety in investigation. Can such a person be trusted to tell us what the writers quoted above thought, or what Margaret McDonald thought, or what John Nelson Darby thought? So Heber's basic point here is that this guy cannot be what? Trusted. Okay? And I'm going to demonstrate that to you, hopefully, if we get far enough, now that I've spent 15 minutes reviewing today, that that is, in fact, the case. So I want to go now to the next point. And this would be to finish up looking at these Jesuits, okay? This claim that futurism and the pre-tribulation rapture originated with the Jesuits, okay? So let's look at, was Manuel de Lacunza the source of the pre-trib rapture? Manuel de Lacunza was born in Santiago, Chile in 1731 and died in Italy in 1801. In 1747, he entered the Jesuit order and was ordained in 1755. When the Jesuit order was expelled from Spain and its colonies in 1767, he went to Italy for study, and there wrote his famous tome, The Coming Messiah in Glory and Majesty, under the pen name Juan Joseph Ben Ezra. Being suspicious, it might be placed on the index of forbidden books by the Roman Catholics. He completed the work in 1790. Before it was published in Cadiz, Spain in 1812, it circulated in manuscript form. And it was placed on the index on September 6, 1824, and again on July 11, 1914. So he writes the book, he doesn't publish it, because he's afraid if he does, it's going to be taken on the Catholic Index of Forbidden Books. When it's finally published in 1812, it is twice placed upon the Catholic Index of Forbidden Books. Now, and this guy is supposed to be a friendly to the Catholic position here, and you're supposed to believe that he originated the futurist position to try to escape the claim that the Pope was the Antichrist. Page 8. John L. Bry, a Southern Baptist and preterist, is also the author of a book titled The Origin of the Pre-Tribulation Rapture Teaching, in which he advances the view that Manuel de Lacunza taught the pre-tribulation rapture. We look at Mormonism, Jehovah's Witnesses, Herbert Armstrongism, etc., because we know that they had their origins with false teachings thought up in modern days by their leaders. But how in the name of Bible truth can Christians look with favor on modern-day inventions by human leaders such as the theory of a pre-tribulation rapture, which never was taught by anyone before 1812 as far as we have any record? Actually, this was the way by which nearly all new cults have their beginnings. Okay, so you and I are just totally crazy, screwy, because we believe in the pre-tribulation rapture, and we might as well be Mormons, according to John Brock. Duncan MacDonald, author of The Rapture of the Saints, states the following regarding the subject. Oh, I skipped one. I did. Sorry. Still talking about Bray here. Brian. It says, and I have not seen but one published book anywhere. And then he says, and I have studied a tremendous number of books on this subject that traced the pre-tribulation rapture teaching back as far as Lacunza. And that quoted very little from Lacunza. I am hoping that all of what I have to say in this little book, tracing in detail the origin of this teaching back to Emmanuel Lacunza's book, will be of help to sincere and honest Bible students in ascertaining the truth about the man. Duncan MacDonald, author of The Rapture of the Saints, states the following regarding this subject. Were the powers court meetings started for the express purpose of bringing to light the secret rapture? The theory had been in print for 6 years in Irving's translation of Lacunza. It had been preached by Irving at his own church and was regarded as one of the distinct tenets of the new Irvingite sect. But the spirit manifestations in connection with the preaching of this new doctrine put the Christian public on their guard, so that it took him 6 years to dispose of the first edition of his translation. Then, in that fateful year 1833, in which Newman floated the Tractarian movement, appeared the cheap popular edition of Lacunza. At about the same time, the powers court meetings were open for the study of prophecy. Would it be a very wild guess to surmise that the anonymous editions of Lacunza were among the promoters of the powers court meetings? So they're saying, they're trying to tie and say that Darby and Irving, well, Irving is obviously related to Lacunza because he translates the book into English, okay? But then they're trying to pin it on the Powers Court meetings and those that are there saying they're essentially teaching the same thing. Lacunza stated his view, now here it is, that at the close of the 1260 days of Daniel 12, which of course includes the 1260 days, the rapture will occur and judgment will be poured out for 45 days. Before the saints return with Christ to the earth, thus at the 1335th day of Daniel chapter 12, like some historicists had done, he viewed the conflagration of 2 Peter 3:10 as occurring just before the millennium, that the saints would return to a renovated earth. He gave a precise time. Now, first we take note of his statement that much before Christ's arrival to the earth, he will have raised the righteous dead and have caught up the living ones. So this is a quote now, these are quotes now from Lacunza's book. He says, from these words of the apostle, which he himself gives us to know, that he spoke by the word of the Lord, we derive two truths of the utmost importance. First, that when the Lord returns from heaven to earth, upon his coming forth from heaven, and much before his arrival at the earth, he will give his orders and send forth his commandment as King and God omnipotent, which is all signified in these words, with a shout, with the voice of the archangel, with the trump of God, and with the voice of the Son of God, those who shall hear it shall forthwith arise, as the evangelist St. John, chapter 5, verse 25, those who hear shall live. But who are these? May it not be all the dead, good and bad, without distinction? It certainly and evidently appears not. Otherwise, St. Paul would not have taught us, upon the word of the Lord, the great novelty of two things absolutely incomprehensible as well as contradictory, to wit, all the individuals of the human race, good and bad, should rise, which could not take place unless all had died, and after the resurrection, that some should still live and remain unto the coming of the Lord. Now, let's go to the next point, because I think they'll clear it up for you. He directly links 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 13 through 17 with the elect in Matthew 24. Besides this, it ought to be remembered that the apostle in this place is speaking of the resurrection of the dead who are in Christ, or those who sleep in Jesus, and not a single word does he speak of other infinite multitudes, doubtless for this very reason, that their time is not yet come. In the same way, speaketh the Lord in the gospel, and pray, consider it, and that ye shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather his elect from the four winds. Matthew 24, verse 30. If you compare this text with that of St. Paul, you will find no other difference than this, that those who are to arise on the coming of the Lord, the apostle nameth those who are dead in Christ, who sleep in Jesus, and the Lord nameth them his elect. Now, he's saying that Paul, in 1 Thessalonians 4, is talking about the same thing that Christ was talking about in Matthew 24. Does everybody understand that? Okay? Thus, Lacunza placed Christians in the time of the tribulation in Matthew 24. But had said that before Christ actually descended to earth, they would be caught up much before his arrival. In volume 2 of The Coming of Messiah in Glory and Majesty, Lacunza concludes that there would be an interval of 45 days. Although it was said at the beginning of the fourth section that it is uncertain how long the great and terrible day of the Lord's coming will endure, that is not the convention. Perturbation and agitation of our globe, yet having now read with greater reflection the 12th chapter of the prophet Daniel, it appears to me that it cannot endure a shorter time than the space of 45 natural days. Whoever readeth this chapter shall at once perceive without the possibility of doubt that there is a prophecy wholly directed to the last times, very immediate upon the coming of the Lord. For as much as there are announced therein these two capital points only, first, the vocation and conversation of the Jews, second, the anti-Christian temptation and tribulation of the Gentiles. Of these, of this latter, the prophet or the angel who speaks to him says that this shall endure in all by the force of 1290 days, which is 40 and 3 months, and from the time of the daily sacrifice shall be taken away, and the abomination that maketh desolate, there shall be 1290 days. Okay, now we've talked about this a little bit before. Which days being concluded, doubtless in the first beginning of the day of the Lord, these words are added, which have ever appeared to me an impenetrable mystery, blessed is he that waiteth and cometh to the 305 and 30 days in Daniel 12:12. The difference between which two periods is exactly 40 and 5. Now, so, what he's saying is very much like what Meade said. That the saints are on earth and they are persecuted by the Antichrist during the tribulation 1260 days. We'll get to that in a second. Then, stage one, the saints are raptured after the 1260 days of tribulation. Again, we have here a post-trib rapture. And the saints are in heaven and then return to with Christ to a new earth after 45 days. So here's the difference. He said that this conflagration here of the earth, this judgment of God on the earth here, is going to last how long?
45
days, and then once again a new earth is presented, and then once the new earth is presented, the saints are going to come back with who?
Christ
back to a new earth. So he's essentially saying the same thing. Now you need to go look at the next 2 points. Why then shall he be blessed who waiteth and abideth alive during these 45 days? Because he will be one of the few untouched by the two-edged sword which proceedeth out of the mouth of the King of Kings, because he will be one of the few clusters which shall remain untouched in the great vine when the vintage is done. Because he will be one of the few which shall not have been deemed an object of the wrath of God Almighty, nor for the wrath of the Lamb, because he will be one of the few having seen this present earth and these heavens, shall be worthy to behold likewise the new heavens and the new earth, which we, according to his promise, do look for. This appeareth to me the true understanding and resolution of that enigma. I invite all the intelligent to examine it with greater attention, considering, as ought to be done, the whole context from the beginning to the end of the chapter. In this examination, it is very natural that some may be stuck with another kind of enigma, which though accidental to the point in hand, might yet occasion a degree of embarrassment, which is that the prophet Daniel makes the anti-Christian tribulation to last for 1290 days and 40 and 3 months, whereas St. John in the Apocalypse assigned to it only the duration of 1260 days, which is 30 days less. This difficulty occasioned me in other times not a little embarrassment until I recollected the words of Matthew 24:22, except those days shall be short, and there shall no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake they shall be shortened. As St. John wrote after this prophecy and promise of Christ, he sets down the time of the great tribulation as exactly abbreviated, and so strikes off 30 days from that time that it was to endure according to the prophecy of Daniel. In a pestilence or conflagration so great and universal, appeareth it to thee in a slight mercy to assuage the fire 30 days before the time of its appointed duration, that all flesh might not perish. Now, a careful reading of the preceding passage reveals the following about Lacuna's scheme. It is after 1260 days that the rapture will occur, a scheme that is very similar to the post-tribulation post-tribulation scheme presented above. According to Lacoon, to the following the coming of Christ on the 1260th day, he will destroy the Antichrist. The day of the Lord will begin and last for 45 days. Since the seals, trumpets, and vials rely all of Revelation 4 through 18 have already occurred, and Christ has come, what occupies the 45 days? It is the conflagration of 2 Peter 3. This great day being at length concluded, the time of the duration we know not, the horrible tempest being overpassed, all the impious and sinful being examined thence, Where was I?
Third line down.
Being exterminated.
Being exterminated thence, and ecliptic and equator being united in one and the same individual line, the whole atmosphere hushed, the air cleansed, the sea quiet, and all the waters gathered into one place, which shall then be appointed, there must necessarily forthwith appear a new earth, a new heaven, and a new terrestrial orb. Okay? And everything widely different from what the present is, even as the present appeared in everything very different after the flood of Noah was passed, and in everything it shall be at last good as it was in its primitive state. I say at least, because it appears to me highly probable that in respect to honor to a person of infinite sanctity as is a man of God, everything upon the globe should renew and amorally itself, taking on its natural aspect and so on and so forth. And I think he gets the point here. What's he saying? He's saying that there's going to be a new what? A new earth. Okay? Now, let's read the following points and we'll take some questions here. It should be clear that his view is that Revelation from chapter 4 to 19 precedes Christ's coming. That the tribulation under Antichrist precedes that coming, at which coming Antichrist is destroyed and the saints are caught up and remain in the air during the 45 days of the day of the Lord, during the conflagration of 2 Peter 3. During which the conflagration of 2 Peter 3 takes place in preparation for the thousand-year reign. What we have is a post-tribulationist variation, a two-stage pre-conflagration coming, not a pre-tribulation rapture or a pre-Revelation 4 rapture, with all its blessed and associated interlocking truths. So, it's clear if you read what he's saying that the saints are on earth while who is persecuting them? The Antichrist. At the end of the 1260 days, at the end of the tribulation, the Lord returns, he catches away the saints, he judges the Antichrist, and then the saints remain with him in the heavens during this 45-day time period where you have the conflagration of the earth and the earth is destroyed by fire during this 45 days. At the end of the 45 days, you have a new earth presented, and then the second stage of this coming, the saints who are in heaven are going to come back with the Lord to the earth to then set off the what? The millennium. There is no way that this guy is teaching a pre-tribulation rapture. Okay? Lacunza thought a variation of futurist post-tribulationism. He believed that the church would go through the 1260 days of tribulation, though he had placed a subsequent 45-day period between the rapture and the return to earth, during which the conflagration of 2 Peter 3:10 was to occur and the saints returned to a renovated earth. Keeping this in mind, the reader may perceive that as we review the development of prophetic views among Irvingites, we may see Lacunza's influence at work. For it was E. Irving who published Lacunza's two volumes in 1827. I hardly need to say that Lacunza is not the source of the doctrine of the pre-tribulation rapture. The interlocking church truth and dispensational truth. Alright, so let's summarize. Okay? Is this guy Lacunza teaching in pre-trib rapture? There is no way, in my mind, that this guy is teaching a pre-trib rapture. Is he teaching a two-stage coming?
Yes.
Is he teaching a rapture? He is teaching a rapture, but when does it happen? At the end of the tribulation, after the 1260 days. He even says that he even tries to explain the difference in the number of days, and so on, and then the saints are captured or raptured away, the Antichrist is destroyed, so on and so forth, and then they are held in the heavens during this 45-day time period where the earth is destroyed by fire, a new earth is presented, then the saints return back to the new earth with the Lord to enter into what? The millennium. Okay? So, I am saying that the pre-tribulation rapture doctrine did not originate with the Jesuit monks, either Rivera or Lacunza. Okay? These men are teaching. Rivera, as we saw 2 weeks ago, he was teaching a mix of historicism, futurism, and Augustinian amillennialism. This individual, Lacunza, is teaching a two-stage coming, and again, he writes this book in 1790 and sits on it. So again, that's 40 years before 1830, when Dave McPherson in those books right there says that anybody ever came up with the idea of a two-stage coming. Okay? Alright, does anybody have any questions about any of this? I should say to you, these are not my views. I hope everybody understands that. Okay? These are not the views that I'm advocating. I'm trying to teach you, though, what these other guys were saying about the subject.
It seems easy to believe that they would not know about things. I mean, they didn't have the resources available that we have now.
Who do you mean they? Who's?
That when the one said that it was never taught before, perhaps they couldn't access that information.
I think it's worse than that. This guy here in particular, who's the leader of this charge, knows and admits that he's wrong. And I'll show you in a few minutes where, to me, the way that he comes up with this is to totally fudge on the research. And there's no excuse, in my opinion, for these guys saying what they say about this stuff. Because, number one, we've looked at least three different schemes now that were all in existence teaching a two-stage coming before 1830. Right? We saw this one first, the two-stage pre-conflagration theory, that was taught by Meade, Increased Matter, and Cotton Matter. Then we saw this one, taught by Morgan Edwards, the pre-1260 day, with a mid-trib rapture before the 1260 day, or 3.5 years before the millennium. Then we see this one with Lacunza, which is very, very similar to the other one, with the exception that he puts how many days in here? 45. But all three of these views, and the different variations of them, all have a two-stage coming. That McPherson said, you can't find before the year 1830. Okay? So, to answer your question, Laura, I think there's a lot more going on here. There is a bent towards... There is a bent towards discrediting this doctrine. This pre-trib doctrine that I think you'll see is very powerful in the minds of some people who don't like it, and they're willing to do whatever they think they need to and say whatever they think they need to discredit it. Please.
I'd like to have you back up for just a second on Lacunza, the Jesuit. That's what we would call the right wing, the fundamentalists of Roman Catholicism. They were big in Spain, and then they were cast out. First of all, I don't understand why the Catholics would have cast out their own people. And then later on, he writes this book, and then his books are banned. I suppose there's that kind of tension within the fellowship of the Catholics. But any other reason for that? Am I asking a question that doesn't really deserve an answer? It just seems puzzling to me that these men are, if anybody's called a Catholic, it's a Jesuit. And yet they are... Anyway, it's interesting to me that he would come independent of what his own fellowship teaches.
This scheme right here, this idea that these guys do this to escape the Protestant interpretation that the Pope is the Antichrist, he ends up teaching something that is so radically different from the Catholic view of the end times that the Catholics can't do anything but throw it out.
Okay.
Because, I mean, he's got all these elements here that, quote, standard Catholic eschatology would not accept. And so they end up having no choice, in my mind, but to say, this guy's a heretic, get this thing out of here. Okay?
So is all this relevant only because of the Catholic Church is afraid that it's pointing to them? As an antichrist?
The only reason all this stuff is even being discussed is because people in our day who don't like the pre-tribulation rapture have sought to discredit Darby and pin its origin on a less than acceptable source. Okay? So the first attempt is to pin it on Jesuit monks. Because if we can pin it on Jesuit monks, then we can say, see, all you pre-tribulation people, you are teaching a Catholic doctrine, and therefore you're what?
Wrong.
But I guess my whole thought is, who cares? 3.5 years, we're in tribulation, we're not in tribulation, we're caught up before the tribulation, we have to, you know, try and live through the tribulation. In the end, we're either right or wrong, and... You know, we either serve Christ or we don't. But
well, first of all, I do care personally to get this right.
Yeah.
Because it affects a lot of what I believe about other things. So I do think it's important that people get accurately identify these issues. But to answer your bigger question, again, the only reason why anybody is discussing this in the context, or at least in the terms that I'm presenting it to you, is again because of these people that want to discredit this doctrine. Okay? Now, the second class, if you look at page 11, the second allegation is that the pre-tribulation rapture originated, so this is the alleged demonic and occult source of the pre-tribulation rapture. Alright? So, alleged demonic and occult source. In 1864, the post-tribulationist S.P. Trengels, I guess that's how I'm going to say it. If I'm wrong, somebody will tell me that. A text critic, he's a famous textual critic, made the following charge. But when the theory of the secret coming of Christ was first brought forward about 1832, it was adopted with eagerness.
What is the secret coming?
The secret coming is that the Lord will return to catch away the saints without any... Oh, prophetic events needing to be fulfilled
without the unsaved understanding? Or
no, in other words, this is a return of Christ that is unique to the Pauline revelation and not revealed in the Old Testament.
Okay.
So, he says that it starts where? 1832. Then he says, I'm not aware that there's any definite teaching that there will be a secret rapture of the church at a secret... had a secret coming until this was given forth as an utterance in Mr. Irving's church from what was then received as being the voice of the Spirit. But whether anyone ever asserted such a thing or not, it was from that supposed revelation that the modern doctrine, the modern phraseology respecting it arose. It came not from, should say, Holy Scripture, but from that which falsely pretended to be the Spirit of God, while not owning the true doctrine of the Lord's incarnation in the same flesh and body as his brethren, but without taint of sin. So what he's saying there is that this doctrine originated in Edward Irving's church in 1832 in the middle of a tongue-speaking meeting. Therefore, it's what? It's wrong. 9 years earlier, in 1835, S.P. Trengels had attributed the doctrine merely to the Judaizers. when he stated the following in an article titled Premillennial Advent in the Christian Annotator on June 16, 1855. It should be noted that these two statements made by Trangles are contradictory. All Christians, of course, believe that what is taught in 1 Thessalonians 4 as to the rising of the dead in Christ when he comes, as this was known to light by John and by those whom he addressed in Revelation 1, their hope is that day, not some secret advent or secret rapture of the Lord, as Judaizers had supposed might be the case. But his coming was very circumstance of publicity and manifest glory. So in 1855, this guy says it came and originated with who? The Judaizers, the teachers of the law. Then he says later in 1864 that it originated in whose church? Irving's church, as a result of the tongue-speaking meeting. All right. In 1840 and 1861, R. Norton, that's Robert Norton, published book that spoke of a revelation that Miss Margaret MacDonald, M.M., of Port Glasgow, Scotland, received. Since R. Norton spoke about it in 1830 in Scotland, it is evident that S.P. Trangles, who spoke about 1832 at Edward Irving's church, did not get his ideas from R. Norton's books. Okay? So the idea here is, if you look at the dates here, it doesn't follow. So this Trangles guy, look at the next point, S.P. Trangles and B.W. Newton were both part of the Plymouth, England gathering of Christians, and therefore had been in fellowship with John Nelson Darby for some time. In 1844, Newton began publishing his Thoughts on the Apocalypse, a post-tribulational work through which John Darby issued a series of written rebuttals. Newton's books were a systematic attack on the resurgence of dispensational truth that had occurred in the minds of John Darby. Though greatly opposed to Darby, Newton never alleged a demonic source for the pre-tribulation rapture as John Nelson Darby understood it. Newton, who was acquainted with the teachings of Irvingism, made no charge of a demonic source. On the contrary, as we have already seen, it was Newton who claimed that about 1830, a Mr. Tweedy suggested 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, to John Nelson Darby as proof of the Lord's immediate coming. Okay, so what do we know? We know that this Trangles guy, he said in 1855 that the pre-tribulation rapture was taught by, or secret rapture was taught by Judaizers. In 1864, he says, no, it first was spoken in a tongues meeting in Edward Irving's church in 1832. And if you look at Newton, B.W. Newton, who was once a buddy of Darby's early on, and they were sort of in fellowship with each other, Newton was a post-tribulationist and wrote a commentary and an opinion on the book of Revelation that put the rapture of the church at the end of the tribulation. But he, who was a friend of Darby's from the beginning and very early on, never suggested that it originated where? That it came from a tongue-speaking meeting in 1832 in Edward Irving's church. In fact, Newton is the one that suggests, if you recall from previous lesson a few weeks back before Christmas, it was Newton that put forth the testimony that Tweedy suggested in 1830 the verses in 2 Thessalonians 2 as being conclusive proof for the pre-trib rapture that John Nelson Darby had already been teaching for at least 3 years. So, writers in Watching and Waiting, a British post-tribulationist publication of strict Baptists, are supporters of Trangle and Newton, and in substance repeat Trangle's charges. The any moment secret pre-tribulation or two-stage coming theory was taught by Edward Irving as a result of a vision received by a woman in his church. Beginning with an Irvingite woman that propagated Mr. John Nelson, beginning with an Irvingite woman, then propagated by Mr. J. N. Darby, this new spirit-inspired doctrine. And third, This strange theory, originally put forth by persons in connection with the Irvingite assembly under the power of evil spirits. So, what is the charge here?
Heresy.
The charge here is that the first people to teach a pre-tribulation rapture were people that were speaking in tongues and under the influence of, you know, spirits, if you will, and Edward Irving's church in 1832. John Nelson Darby got a hold of it and then taught it from there, but its true origin was in this tongue-speaking meeting at Edward Irving's church in 1832, and therefore everybody that doesn't believe in speaking in tongues as legitimate will now say, or that the charge is designed to make them think that this is all of spurious Pentecostal influence, and therefore none of it is actually what?
True.
J.B. Payne, the former Old Testament professor at Wheaton College, stated the following in The Imminent Appearing of Christ. Soon after 1830, a woman, while speaking in tongues, announced the, quote, revelation that the true church would be caught up, should say raptured, to heaven before the tribulation and before Christ returned to earth. Edward Irving was deposed from his ministry and died in 1834, but not before his pre-tribulationism had been introduced at the Powers Court meetings. There, the Irvingite view received the enthusiastic support of Darby and others. Now look, who was it that translated this guy Lacunza's book?
Irving.
Does this have anything to do with a pre-trib rapture? So again, folks, it is only people who don't like this doctrine who would seek to pin it on Irving or anybody that had anything to do with this church. Because if you read the book that Irving translated and published, he's not teaching a pre-tribulation rapture. Okay? Any questions about that?
Didn't Irving eventually plant the seeds for Seventh-day Adventists? Isn't that a direct connection?
I'm not sure about that.
No?
I'm not sure about that. I don't know. Page 13. Robert Baxter, a lawyer, had joined the Irvingites in London, England during the early 1830s and became one of their prophets. At some point, Baxter left the Pentecostal confusion of the Irvingites. In 1836, he wrote an expose titled Irvingism in its Rise, Progress, and Present State, in which we find his testimony about what Irving and his followers actually held concerning the Second Advent. The first testimony from the utterance on the nearness and coming of Christ and the fearful judgments which immediately what? Now, does that sound like a rapture here before the tribulation or a rapture here at the end of the tribulation? So this is a guy that was in the group, got fed up with it and left it, and is now writing a book saying what they were actually teaching. The first testimonies from the utterance were on the nearness of the coming of Christ and the fearful judgments which would immediately precede it. And the minds of Mr. Irving and his followers had been prepared for this a long course of prophetic study, and the opening and upholding of their prophetic views formed one of the means by which the utterances commended themselves to their consciences as God, as from God. So in other words, they were open to all of this tongue-speaking things that we've already talked about, and so when these things start to happen, they view them as obviously God working. This was the position of the affairs when I unhappily joined them. I don't know why he would say that. He joined them, he seemed like he wanted to when he started. On January 14, 1832, I became a practitioner in the power of utterance and was recognized by Mrs. Caird, Mrs. J., and Miss E. Cardell. Notice how these are all women. Miss Hall and Mr. Kaplan as equally gifted with themselves. There was an utterance from Miss Cardell in April 1832, which stated the word was true, but contained a mystery. I know not what is to be inferred from Miss Cardell's message. So here's a guy that was recognized with the same power that all these other people had. She says this thing about the word containing a secret or whatever, and this guy says he didn't even know what she was talking about, and he reports that they were teaching at the beginning of that quotation in bold, the first testimonies from these utterances were on the nearness of the coming of Christ and of the fearful judgments which would immediately what? That is not talking, folks, about a pre-tribulation rapture. Okay? Now, we're going to have to finish this point and then stop before we start talking about the Scottish girl. Not only does Baxter himself indicate that no one knew what Miss Cardell meant by her utterance, that the word contained a mystery, but he clearly states that Irvingites were teaching in 1832 that fearful judgments would immediately precede the coming of Christ. Therefore, it is clear that Darby did not get his teaching on the rapture from the Irvingites. Now, I hope, again, I hope this isn't boring to you. Okay? But I think you'll see in the end why I'm spending so much time on this. Okay? The next one that we're going to start halfway down page 13 now for next week is this charge of McPherson that it came from a tongue-speaking cultic woman in Scotland. Alright? So, did it come from the Jesuits?
No.
Did it come from the Irvingites? I'm going to say what?
No.
If you study what these guys are actually teaching, if you study what they're actually saying, they believe in some variation form of what we have, what we've had up here on the board, on the wall all morning. Okay? And all of these things are being said and being done again to try to discredit the pre-trib rapture. You see how the one guy said, well, anybody that believes in the pre-trib rapture is the same as a Mormon, the same as a, you know, Seventh-day Adventist, the same as, you know, any other person that might be recognized as being not necessarily on the up and up theologically. Lyle, you got a question?
Well, I'm just thinking. There's lots of things. Well, and if I just guess, I did have a comment. It almost seems to me that when I listen to all that, that Satan has to be part of this underlying culture because he hates the truth. And I'm just amazed at how much he does, you know, it's a fact.
Look, grab the Appendix A. This is, to me, an example here of what Paul calls doctrines of devils. Okay? I'm just going to say something brief about this, and we'll talk about it in more detail next week. If you look at the appendix, you'll notice that about from the bottom of the page down where it says she writes. Does everybody see that?
Yeah.
Everything from there on, and then you'll notice that there are some lines that are underlined and some lines that are not. Does everybody see that? Okay? Now, the lines, let me make sure I get this right. There, this R. Norton guy, in 1840, he wrote a book called Memoirs of James and George McDonald of Port Alaska. Okay? And he records from the hand of this woman, Mary McDonald, what her supposed revelation was. And he records it in his book in 1840. Okay? Now, in 1861, he writes another book, a second book. And what you see on this sheet, folks, is all of the lines that are underlined are lines that are in both books, the 1840 book and the 1861 book. The lines that are not underlined appear only in the original edition of 1840. Is everybody following that? Now, just real quick, and I will go over this in a lot more detail, but it speaks to Lally's point. In his 1861 book, he claims that this tongue-speaking Scottish girl was the first one to teach a pre-tribulation rapture. So he does this in his second book. Now, if you would go to page 21, there are two sentences that are separated. I have them bolded, but you'll notice they are not what? So these are sentences that were in the 1840 book, but did not appear in the 1861 book, in which he claimed that this girl was the source of the pre-tribulation rapture. Just read the sentences. Read the first one here. It says, "'Tis the fiery trial which is to try us. It will be for the purging of the real members of the body of Jesus.'" The previous sentence says, "Now will the wicked one be revealed with all power, signs, and lying wonders, so if it be possible, if it were possible, the very elect will be deceived. 'Tis the fiery trial is to try who? Us. Now where does she put them? She puts them in the tribulation, under trial by the Antichrist. This guy leaves that sentence out of his 1861 book when he says that she's the first one to teach a pre-tribulation rapture. Then look at the next one down there. The trial of the church is from who? Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? This woman, in her original, quote, revelation, taught that the church would be on earth and persecuted by who? So this guy leaves those sentences out of his 1861 book when he then states that she is the origin of the pre-tribulation rapture, knowing full well that the original sentences were in his 1840 book. Now, you want to know the kicker? This guy, McPherson, then, where did he get the idea that the pre-tribulation doctrine originated with this tongue-speaking Scottish girl in Fort Glasgow, Scotland in 1830? He got it from R. Norton's 1861 book. And you know what McPherson does? Look at this. Does this look familiar to you? That appendix I got from whose book? Now don't tell me that this guy is not bent, unreasonably so, against disproving the pre-tribulation rapture. Because that appendix that says that the girl taught the church would be on earth and persecuted by the Antichrist, he includes in his own book. And I'm supposed to just believe what he's telling me and everything else he says. You follow what I'm saying? Now, we'll talk more about that next week. But I encourage you maybe between next week and this week to read Appendix A. Okay? Any last minute comments or questions?
Well, Pastor, you seem to be apologetic for taking so long. I think, frankly, to unravel this, even for those of us who have been familiar with some of these things, it's still important to get that documentation in our mind. Because, frankly, if I were to go hear somebody ask me some of this stuff, I got to think about it a little bit more before I can repeat some of it, be sure. So I just want to encourage you, don't forget about the clock.
Okay.
All right. We're all enjoying it.
What?
It's good for us to know that you're
Well, that's been my main concern the whole time. And by the way, that appendix is in every one of these books. Okay? All right, we got to quit. Thanks for your time. We'll be in here again next week. And we'll finish part three now, I guess, on these notes. And we'll talk about it later. So keep your notes. Bring them to